Welcome to Podcast on Fire 128, lacking an episode title right now. Well, half an episode title we do have. It's Tom on Fire, aka something. So that should tell you something if you know your Podcast on Fire episodes. And this is Kenny B, and therefore Tom KW is in the room again.
Good morning, everyone.
It's been a while.
Yep, good to be back.
It's been a while.
Shaking off the dust, the cobwebs on my ears and stuff, getting back into it.
Because that's how real life works. Because Tom doesn't do anything when he's not podcasting, and then when he is called into action, you know, dust himself off. But how are you? What you been up to?
Not a lot, mate. Not a lot at all. Just relaxing, been ill the past week, so kind of balancing that with working kind of a bit later at work. So my sleep schedule's been a bit over the shop, but not too bad. I've been able to kind of sit and down with a couple of movies that I started and managed to finish.
Ooh. Mm.
So
progressing, Mr. Tom KW, finishing shit.
So been relaxing, mate, enjoying the show from behind closed doors. So definitely a lot of stuff on the network, exciting stuff.
Yeah, I know.
Glad to be a part of it, mate. Yeah,
we're the best.
We are best.
No modesty whatsoever. Yeah, we rock. We'll get to that, what we've been doing recently, but this is, as I said, a Tom on Fire edition of Podcast on Fire going on again, and it was a successful experiment last time we did that thing where we talked. We had a conversation, a discussion,
what?
Rather than me babbling about tits and poo and filth and reviewing obscure Hong Kong films and working you guys like puppets. You know, you guys are finally being set free, and you're grown up now. And what a rousing success it was with, in all seriousness, with episode 125, Tom on Fire, aka Come On, Let's Make Happy. And in all seriousness, it was a good idea to bring in some discussion points and see where that gets us, and it got us some pretty decent places, and the feedback was rather thrilling to see, actually. So so good on you, Tom. It's a standing so to say segment, a theme, a direction of an episode. Tom on Fire, aka something.
Kenny, you were my Dennis Rodman to my Van Damme. Do you know what I mean? It was a double team. It was a double team.
Well, I do dress rather experimentally. So
me too, wigs and all.
Yeah, got piercings, piercings in obscure, not obscure, but weird places.
Let's not.
Or
say
do
anything.
I? Yeah. But anyway, we'll do some regular segments first, and then the second half is the Tom on Fire section. So we'll reveal the subjects that Tom has gathered for us. So once we get to that, then we'll see where it gets up. I think that this is going to be good. And anyway, this is Podcast on Fire on the Podcast on Fire Network. An email for contact information, and we have been getting email. I will read an actual fan email, not a hate email. I was expecting that. We'll read parts of that during the end of the network update. So it is working, and that is podcastonfire@googlemail.com. The forum, or as I like to say, it's rather the archive by now, which is not a bad thing, is podcastonfire.com/forum. The reason is we're not taking registrations anymore, so the core that registered before, including you, Tom, prior to you being a host on the network, still have access to the forum and the members-only archive of cut conversations and the outtakes and all the exclusive stuff we used to do. We still do exclusive stuff, but we put that in the bonus episodes section on the website. And those are exclusive website-only podcasts. You can't find them on iTunes or Stitcher, and as I usually say, because this week in Sleaze we'll have a bonus episode sometime, it's a good thing that they don't travel outside of the website. Some shows shouldn't go anywhere else, including the boner episodes from this week in Sleaze. So we'll get to see that. And the guys on the forum are now pretty much discussing on Facebook, so we have two endeavors over there. We have our regular page, facebook.com/POF network. Click like, the good old like, thumbs up, and come interact with us there. But mainly we do our discussion in the Facebook discussion group that you can reach by typing in Podcast on Fire Network and a discussion group, as well as the page will come up in the search results. You do that in the Facebook search bar. And also follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/podcastonfire. And you'll see, obviously, the network from us, but also Stu's updates from his viewing habits, rather, you can see. And also maybe some updates about a short film Stuart is putting together. So look for updates regarding that. I do my writing on SoGoodReviews.com and SleazyKVideo.com. And the latest to be put up, I always forget to check that. Again, because the mixture is Taiwanese, Category 3, IFD, cut and paste, IFD not cut and paste, what have you. But it was in the case of the movie Be Careful, Sweetheart. It was a Taiwanese wuxia with Adam Cheng and Bridget Lin from 1984. And a rather, and Derek Yee, by the way, he's in it as well. A rather cool one. It's not a Shaw Brothers movie or anything. It's a Taiwanese, but a well-made and high-budget swordplay movie with a bit of humanity as well. Not one of those complex wuxias where you can't follow the twists at all. At least that's my experience with certain out of that genre. After a while, you just turn off and enjoy the pretty colors and the fantasy elements on display. But this one, you
pretty
could...
Colors.
Yeah, pretty. But that's okay as well. But this one had some humanity, a welcome human side, as well as being a kick-ass and violent movie. So Be Careful, Sweetheart, nice, with Adam Cheng and Bridget Lin. And SleazyKVideo.com is where you'll find video reviews of that and other movies that I review for the from the main review section, so to say. And follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/SoGoodReviews. And you like to hear your podcast via iTunes, I hear. Do I hear that? Yes, I hear that.
Yes.
And you can therefore subscribe to the Podcast on Fire Network via iTunes and leave us a rating and comment if you like the show. We would very much appreciate that. But if you, like me, prefer to stream your podcasts, if you're very careful and paranoid about using up all your space on your device, that's me, you can stream us via Stitcher. Stitcher Radio is available from Stitcher.com as an app. You can download that to your computer, but it's also available for the various smartphones and tablets out there, including the iPhone. It's a free application. And once you're in Stitcher, type in Podcast on Fire Network, and you can add each show individually, including the Two-Fisted Podcast soon. I've sent in the submission for it to be added, but I haven't heard back yet. But all the other shows otherwise, including Taiwan Noir, is up there. You have a review archive on VCinema, of course, Tom. I haven't followed the updates if you submitted any reviews lately or not. Not that I'm going to put
dusting off as well. Yeah, dusting off the cobwebs on that one as well.
Right. I didn't mean to put you against the wall or anything. No, I haven't done anything. I'm sorry, Ken. But VCinema is, I wanted to plug their 44th episode regardless, which is their review of Choi Hawk's Green Snake. Mm. And it, as usual, with Coffin John and Josh, a.k.a. the Great Lord, Joshua Regal, and Dr. Stanglik, they had they have great banter, great chat, good chemistry, and they provided us with a great review of Choi Hawk's Green Snake and some background information on him and on Mseyun and Seasonal and what have you. So check out their 44th episode on thecinemashow.com or follow the link in the show post of this episode, because that blog, because it is a blog as well, it's very busy, constantly having reviews posted and what have you. So that episode might not be at the top of the page at the time of this recording. So you'll get a direct link to the episode via the show links in the show post for this episode. Not that it really matters, but is VCinema one of those shows that you like want to catch right away, or you'll catch it eventually?
Let's just say I was listening to about 15 podcasts about a month ago, and I've cut them down to 6. VCinema made the cut. Let's just say that.
and off air, he said, by the way, VCinema was the one that was let go first, but don't let that be in the recording. Okay.
Fucking Josh on my ass, man.
Network updates, if you want. As the backlog was getting full of special shows recorded and finished and edited special shows, I followed a listener advice. I think it was Ian Davis, our good friend Ian Davis, and rolled out a show prematurely, so to say, because the special shows I put up every 2 weeks, and this show you're listening to is a weekly one. But I put out a show prematurely, if you will, making this week a whopping free podcast release type
you
of
crazy
week.
Man, I love you. You crazy.
Thanks. I don't know where that's from, so I can't ad lib with you.
Oh no.
Thank you.
Just go.
The one I rolled out prematurely because I was planning the other one anyway was This Week in Sleaze 8 on Rape by an Angel, which is only the first part of our, that is me, Not me, by the way. Sleazy K is a different character, obviously. But Sleazy K is the great Lord Joshua Regal's coverage of the Rape My Angel series, which only had one, or rather two. Two of the ones in the series were rated Category 3, the other ones were not. But we are going to check them all out. Because as we go through in the second episode covering Rape My Angel 2 and 3, we witnessed that the Category 2B rating is one that where you can push quite a bit and still make a movie that feels like a Category 3 movie. So it's an interesting angle to take. We will, at the end of that coverage, roll out a bonus episode, or boner episode, on the second... It's funny, isn't it? Every time you say boner episode, we're dudes. It's like, yeah, he said boner. But I encourage that. You know, I'm almost 33 years old, and I still find that funny. So I'm kind of glad that I got my sensibilities intact. Maybe it's just me that feels like that's a positive thing to have in your life. But regardless,
I'm glad to hear I got another decade of laughing at cocks to come, Ken.
But the bonus episode anyway will contain a discussion of the unsubtitled second fifth Rape by an Angel, directed by Dick Lau. That's a true story. I mean, his English name is Dick Lau. I've seen one of his movies, actually. Emmanuel in Hong Kong, I think it was called. And to be honest, it was quite a stylish movie, considering it was a low-budget softcore movie. Looked good. So maybe it looks good, but unfortunately no subtitles. But we'll try and get some material out of that. You know, it's a bonus episode after all. It's no pressure, really. But the one we've scheduled beforehand was the second episode of Taiwan Noir. It was released this past Wednesday, and the series kind of firmly started with this episode. I did a solo chat and the setup of the series, but this one was where it finally started, and I was joined by what should be frequent co-host John Charles, which is a writer and author and associate editor, I think is his title, on Video Watchdog. He's been doing that for quite a long time. And hope you all enjoyed that. We covered the crucial social realist movie On the Society File of Shanghai, starring Liu Xiaofan, or Liu Xiaofan, my wife.
That she doesn't know about.
Nope. Doesn't need to know. But what I do know is it's a fine debut performance that we never really saw until a few years earlier. We never saw any evidence of that until a few years rather later, when she was getting dramatic material again. In between, there were some more sexy roles, if you will, genre role, exploitation roles, which is not a bad thing, but it's funny to see, like, we loved her in this movie, let's put her in something else that is sexy, because they made a sexy poster. But it's interesting, and not a bad thing. She won awards left and right after all in the 80s, so great actors. And I hope you all enjoyed that, and it's a thrill. On a personal note, and I'm sure you can relate to this also, Tom, because you are on special shows. It's a thrill for us to roll out these, because it's hard but passionate and rather easy work, to be honest, because, and this applies to all of you, not just John Charles or Stuart or, you know, everyone, you and David.
Everyone but
great.
David.
of course, David's included. I mean, it's only Phil that's not included, you know. but you know what? Especially with great speakers in the room, in all seriousness, these shows do turn out really well, and I wouldn't be anything without you guys. Aww. So that's true. You know, it's about bouncing off each other, okay, in a non-gay way. But you're all doing great work, and the director series will, or obviously your contribute a lot to that, but and that will return eventually. Obviously, we have an episode in the pipeline, but it's the one where we finally argue a little bit.
Ooh, yeah,
the trio,
yeah.
Yes. Remember that? Like the fuck genie, man.
There was some fuck yous dropped. Yeah. Yes, yeah. There was.
But we'll get to that when it becomes more current, when that show is near release. But also behind the scenes this week, there are now two backup shows recorded of this very show, Podcast on Fire. As there are weeks when we can't get together due to life, focus on other shows, focus on research. And I do want fresh content if I can put it out every week. So one show I recorded was a solo chat on Chang Che's Blood Fucking Everywhere Massacre Flick, the duel with David Chiang and Dick Leung. Fantastic movie. It should be the full title. It's a fantastic movie. Have you seen the duel?
I haven't, mate. I haven't, no. It's one I need to check
you
down.
Should check it out. I mean, it's slightly more modern, but it's a basher, you know, a knife, lots of knife action. Good usage of the type of Chang'e violence, which includes...
The early 70s kind of just rough. Yeah,
and it's loud, and it's loud as well. Love that stuff. Check it out. One of the very best. And 1971 was filled with reference work. You know, New One on Swordsman, Death, The Anonymous Heroes, Deadly Duo, which is a fucking fantastic movie. So they were on such a roll, especially in 71. So check that out. And I also included some notes on Iron Fist Pillage, which is a redub done by rappers and black actors, if you will, in order to make the duel cool and gangsta and funny. And it's not. It's the dumbest thing I've ever seen. And I sat through Kung Pao Enter the Fist. I know. You know what? It's as easy as this. It's a joke that could have worked for maybe 1 minute, if that. But then someone got really, really fucking stoned. And they cranked out this very cheap product. And they're not funny. We're not dealing with persons that have delivery, you know, can deliver raunchy humor, you know, because there's erection jokes and weed jokes and fingering jokes or what have you. Normally, I would laugh my ass off if it was delivered by someone who knew how to deliver that shit. But, you know, it's like some friends got together, smoked up. And, you know, I'm not being stereotypical in terms of, you know, weed and black people and anything, but it's not funny, and it's so
very
long.
Stereotypical, yeah, it's very stereotypical.
And so
it's a common thing now to kind of associate kind of you know, that kind of urban kind of Wu-Tang thing with kung fu films, and it becoming associated to the point where people think that they don't have to put any effort into actually making things funny or to make things link. They just put these two kind of opposing, you know, genres and cultures together, and they think they're going to come up with something funny, and rarely does it work. I mean, it was funny the first time. I think if everyone remembers Kung Fao or Kung Fo.
Oh, don't.
Which I found funny for a bit, but I think that was because it was kind of one of the first kind of shows to do that, to kind of mix the kind of the urban nature.
A TV series. It was not one skit. Yeah. It was, you know, it must have gotten old pretty quickly. Yeah,
it's true. I mean, I watched the first episode, I enjoyed it, but I can see why people would find it annoying, because I've definitely found it annoying on kind of things after that, as you said, Ken, with stuff like that. It's just too stereotypical now.
And I mean, I'm not a fan of the Wu-Tang Clan, because it's not really my type of music, but I'm sure they weren't, like, you know, setting out to make fun of the genre,
no,
you know.
I mean, it was respect, really, and I think a lot of people, you know, I'm a fan of Wu-Tang, and I think a lot of people who are fans understand that really it was kind of a, you know, RZA himself is just big into the culture and a big fan of the culture and a part of it, whereas people from that and derivatives of that have kind of took it as a parody and really kind of parodied off that and spun off that, things that are not very funny and things that were kind of far removed from what the Wu-Tang originally set out to do.
Well, I think the reputation of the Wu-Tang Clan is strong enough not to, you know, diminish anything like that. I mean, people still remember them for the good they did, and whoever made lame stuff after that, they're not remembered. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, I just watched Iron Fist Pillage because it was on the same custom DVD that my friend put together, just because I'm going to hell anyway, so... might as well, but there are only minor notes in the episode on it. But the second backup show that we recorded was me and Dave, Hong Kong Dave. We continued our banana ripening series coverage, and that started, if you don't know what that is, in episode 127 with our review of Yester You, Yester Me, Yesterday. And the continuation meant that we reviewed the sequel, the Joe Ma directed sequel, Over the Rainbow, Under the Skirt. And these are essentially the Hong Kong versions of the Fred Savage TV series, The Wonder Years. Do you remember that at all?
The Wonder Years? I mean, I wasn't around to kind of experience it firsthand, but yeah, I know about The Wonder Years.
And it's really well... how do you say, it's not a lame copy. They used the template of nostalgia and growing up and took it to and placed it in Hong Kong very well. So it's not a lame take of the Wonder Years or anything. It's very sweet, and has the licensed usage of the Bee Gees, The First of May, that song, which is a beautiful song. You know, I'm on the record on saying that I hated the Bee Gees, but I only knew one song. and it was Staying Alive, which is a horrible song.
Hey, but, let's not get into that.
But okay. they made beautiful music prior, you know, and I'm sure afterwards as well. But the First of May is a fantastic driving force for the themes in these films.
Are you trying to tell me You Should Be Dancing is not beautiful?
I haven't heard that, you know. I haven't heard that. So, I'm
you'll be boogieing straight away, Ken.
Oh, boy,
honestly,
oh boy.
You'll be on your feet. No doubt.
Yeah.
I don't dance.
So all of those will be rolled out, those backup episodes, when we can't record for you, but want to give you anyway. So we'll see exactly when those gets rolled out. And as always, hit us up with some feedback on email or in the discussion group. We always love to hear from you. And I want to thank in particular David Wells, who sent over an email to podcastonfire@googlemail.com, and he had some very kind words to say about Taiwan Noir. So I'd like to quote a little bit from his email. So, quote, "I just wanted to say hello and tell you how much I enjoyed learning about Liu Xiaofen on your recent Taiwan Noir podcast. Although I remember her well from Song of the Exile, I simply wasn't aware of her career. You've definitely piqued my curiosity, but then again, I have a soft spot for the obscure obsessions of fellow movie fanatics. So thanks for putting the spotlight on Taiwan's genre films. They've been unduly neglected and deserve more attention. I'm eager to learn more myself." So thank you, David. Thanks, buddy. I sent you an email, but I want to thank you on the show as well. You'll keep listening, we'll keep producing, we'll entertain ourselves, and hopefully you as well. So it is a chance, this, the Podcast on Fire Network, to educate ourselves and to give an overview of Asian cinema we know of and don't know of, but also we can give that to you listeners, hopefully, and even to those looking for Chinese hardcore pornos, we got those covered as well,
which there are many people. Yep.
Yep. So thank you very much, David. That was a very kind thing to do, to send over. So
lovely, man. Yeah, lovely to hear.
And last movies watch, I don't have anything to talk of. This was a slow week for me. I only watched the movies I talked of on the shows I mentioned, so I want to talk of them again. So what about you, Tom? What have you been catching up with?
Yep, I'll jump through quickly so we can get to the main beef of the episode, but I rewatched Better Tomorrow 3 after years of not seeing it. Originally saw it on VHS, didn't like it, didn't return to it, but I like it. A lot. I'd say a lot better than I remember. I definitely rank it better than 2 in my eyes. That might be controversial, but I definitely rank it better than 2 because I think it's just a lot more fleshed out and less of a kind of a comic book and more of a kind of a emotional a ride. I think Anita Moy is stunning in it. The action scenes work. This was the new cut, which is sort of a hybrid cut on the newest Fortune Star release, which contains some scenes from the Taiwan cut, is it, Ken? I think you went through. Yeah, it contains some scenes from that, but not all the scenes. So it's pretty much, it clocks in about 2 hours.
I think the longer cut is actually very, it's not too, it doesn't have a lot of padding. So because I really like the longer cut as well.
It was brisk. I mean, I haven't seen that cut. That's the longest. I think it contains a few more scene extensions than what I saw. But I don't know what cut it was on the Made in Hong Kong VHS.
Probably cinema cut, because it's the one I saw first, the one I own on VHS, and 100 minutes so, and the longer cut in its full form is about 20 minutes longer than that, 120, 130 minutes or something. Yes, and Fortune Star is maybe 110 or something.
I think it was just under or just over 2 hours. This is the newest cut. So yeah, I mean, I mean, a lot of people would obviously, they're going to compare it to Bullet to the Head, because they're pretty much John Woo and Choi Hawk working from the same script, but working from the same place when they made these films. They pretty much set out to make kind of prequels to the original one. And I think, although John Woo's film is the better film, I think this in itself as a prequel to, you know, one of the best Hong Kong cinema films of all time, works, not completely and not for the whole runtime, but I think everyone's great in it. The acting was great. Everyone seemed to be on board with what they were doing. The action scenes were surprisingly a lot better than I thought they were. They came and they really kind of hit me. And yeah, there were stretches here and there where I thought, yeah, I mean, this is kind of taking time. But then again, it picked right back up. And I mean, with an ending that was really emotional as well, I got a lot more engaged into it than I thought it was going to be. So, I mean, overall, I'd rank it slightly higher than the second one. Mm.
I was always engaged by it. It was one of the first Hong Kong movies I saw. The first one I saw on a original VHS I picked up The Made in Hong Kong VHS, which has a crappy title of Better Tomorrow, The Making of a Killer. In actuality, I think one of the longer titles for it is Better Tomorrow, Love and Death in Saigon. But regardless, I think it's a... I do rank it above 2 as well, and I think it works as a prequel. It's different in feel in terms of action, but it still has... It doesn't have as much splatter, if you will. Choi Hawk and Joe Wu direct different action. You know when you see it how it's different, I can't explain. But it is rather rousing.
Yeah, I heard a lot of complaints about people going to say, oh, it was a bit too cheesy, when there's certain moments that kind of... that connect that film to the first one with certain objects and stuff like that, but I never for a second felt like, yeah, it's a bit too much.
In all honesty, Tom, I can agree with that to an extent, that it could have worked without being connected to A Better Tomorrow. You know, it seems like it was at times shoehorned in, but I still didn't mind it, you know. And the score is fantastic. It's a low score, and Nita Moy is iconic as hell, you know, in a long white coat, you know, dual guns. I mean, how can you complain about the action when you got that, and at the end got Chow Yun-Fat with dual machine guns? You know, that's a fantastic image, and you know, Chow Yun-Fat is on, despite this being his umpteenth movie in 1989, so I agree, they're on them.
Imagery alone, and just, I mean, the film works on its own merits. I think it's definitely underrated, and I kind of advise people just check it out if you kind of, as me, didn't really think much of it the first time around. Second time around really kind of works. I also managed to finish off Little Big Soldier.
What'd you think of it?
Which I'd started, and it kind of wasn't connecting with me a bit, and I kind of dropped it, and then I rewatched it, and it's pretty cool. I don't think it was the kind of rousing success as a lot of people have said it was, or what I've heard. It's so low-key and a lot more of a human story than people would probably expect from a Jackie Chan vehicle. Mm-hmm. But I enjoyed it, despite not being overtly emotionally engaged. I still found it quite sweet and enjoyable. And Jackie and Lee Hong Wang, they got a very believable chemistry. It was even good to see Iron Monkey himself show up within the first 10 minutes.
Show out again, if you will. He's out of it pretty quickly.
I think that the cinematography made it out to be very kind of bleak kind of filmmaking. It was a lot kind of dark, kind of, it felt like kind of a very dark, kind of stark drama, but there are these really kind of sweet moments between the two leads. And I think originally it was supposed to be, Jackie was supposed to be in the opposing role.
I haven't read any history on it, to be honest.
I think it's reading up a bit. I think that's what I've heard. I don't know whether it's true or not, but yeah, I mean, it was a pet project for him, and he had the script sitting around for years, and he finally got to made it. And yeah, I mean, I think it's good, because I see Jackie jumping in these roles now where it's roles which are suiting to the man and his age.
Yes.
And he's doing roles that are graceful, and even, you know, Shinjuku Incident, you know, films like this where he's kind of, he's branching out, but not branching out too much to alienate his core audience, but branching out to kind of start, you know, roles which fit him a lot more better now in his age.
That's why I liked it a lot more, because that didn't feel like, you know, a Jackie Chan vehicle per se. You know, you didn't think that it was a Jackie Chan vehicle. They didn't inject action just because they had to. One of the main action scenes is even the dream sequence. So
And the action itself, just comment on it slightly, is it's not in your face. It's not, you know, it's just kind of small, kind of as the rest of the film, just low key, kind of, you know, good action, well choreographed. There's some really kind of funny sequences as well with Jackie Chan the Bull, which I'm not going to spoil. But overall, yeah, I think that's probably why I kind of shut it off, then returned to it, because cinematography was a bit drab. It seemed like a lot kind of, not a lot of stuff going on, but I think when you get into it and you start getting on with the characters themselves, start kind of bonding with the characters, it's a very, very fun ride. And I think
it's a drab world, though, and I like that, because you might have expected a big Chinese costume epic, but then you don't, and yes. and it all takes place next to events, you know.
It's very interesting if you think about it. Yeah, it's not what you would expect from looking at the kind of the cover and the advertising. It's completely different. I think it works a lot better than I think a film like that would, starring Jackie Chan.
Without spoiling anything, you've seen Jackie tackle drama and melodrama throughout the years. You know what I think of when it doesn't work.
Yep.
You know, mainly New Police Story. You know, here it's what did you think of his low key skills in delivering drama? There's a key sequence when they're rowing in a boat, and he talks of a story. What did you think of that scene without spoiling?
I mean, it was very emotional. The ending itself, it was very emotional as well, and I think he did. I mean, I don't think New Police Story is bad as that.
Yes,
for me,
it is.
I still enjoy the film, even though I think that it's probably a bit too much at times. But here, he's really kind of reeled it in. I mean, what was New? I mean, that's five years ago now. I think New Police Story was, or 6 years ago. So I think from there, I mean, that was really him kind of jumping into a dramatic role, a really strong dramatic role for only the second or third time. So I don't blame him for kind of, you know, trying to take it up a notch. But here, he really kind of. It feels like he's learning now that he needs to kind of tone it down.
He knew already in Crime Story. That's my problem with New Police Story. Don't you remember what's fucking happened in 93?
it just felt like with that film, there was, from the script, and he must have read the script and felt like this is something he needs to do, where he needs to kind of be big because, you know, he played alcoholic and all this stuff, and it was a lot of a different role. But I feel like he's definitely learning now. He needs to kind of tone it down a bit and kind of tone it down more. I mean, obviously, you say more with your face and, you know, same all with kind of little remarks here and there, then big crying and, you know, shouting and over kind of dramatics. And it works
Did he actually cry in the scene? Because I remember he just, like, wiped his tear or something like that.
To me, it was
perfect.
You know, well, perfect, yeah. You know, one tear there and he wipes it away. And that alone says so much more than bawling and fucking pint full of tears that they did in New Police Story, so a lot more successful in terms of the dramatic status. This in Shinjuku Incident, I feel that he's really kind of making waves now.
Yeah, definitely. It was encouraging to see that the skill was there, when the dedication was there and the material was there in terms of Little Big Soldier. Shinjuku Incident worked largely. There was some elements where you go, really? But it was not due to Jackie Chan. It was mainly due to Daniel Wu's development when he turns into the Joker, essentially. You know? Really?
Really? Yeah. I think it would have been a perfect film, aside from what you've just mentioned. Yeah, I do like Daniel Wu, but I felt that was a bit too much. A mistake.
But I'd happily return to it. I actually have a mention of Shinjuku Incident in our discussion later on as well.
Ooh, lovely.
All right, though. Anything else?
Nope, that's it, mate.
Okay, can't we talk about some nipple slicing and eyeball slicing that me and David did last week?
Keep it that show.
I got a funny one, a jokey one from Paul Fox. You know, I turned into Podcast on Fire reviewing Yes to You, Yes to Me yesterday, only to hear talks of nipple and eyeball slicing. and that was me and David, of course, because he knew of the movie, talking of New York Ripper, the Fulci movie. So all good.
Yeah.
But okay, that's us for this first half. If we are taking a break, and then it's Tom on Fire. the trademark howl for that segment. So, but stick with us, and we'll be right back. So welcome back, and as you know, it is Tom on Fire today tonight, and Tom brought a well-honed sense of picking topics last time we did Tom on Fire, and he has done that this show as well. So I'll let Tom moderate and head this discussion. You picked two topics for us, yeah?
Yep, we've got two topics. I don't know how well they're gonna mesh, but we'll see.
Hits and balls.
Yeah,
no,
that's
no.
How,
okay, yeah.
We can either do the first or second. Do you want to do the handover one first, Ken?
Sure. It's the one I have most of the notes on, so go ahead.
Yeah, we'll just jump on. I mean, genuinely, it's just, you know, talking about, do we believe... I mean, I hear a lot from people kind of who love Hong Kong cinema, or just, you know, fans, or, you know, people that, you know, review the cinema. It's that there's a kind of a thing going around that some people believe post-handover cinema, so we're talking, you know, post-1997 here, has lost its soul, or, you know, from previous decades in Hong Kong cinema, or, you know, it's in some way less creative than pre-1997 cinema. And really, it's just, I think it's, for me personally, it splits down the middle. It's kind of a bit, you know, it's kind of a give and take, really, with a lot of this. I think, in general, it's lost some of its quirkiness and energy, but I do think there's actually better films being made, in terms of, you know, cinematically, in terms of, you know, the budget and the way it looks, and, you know, the kind of overall, I don't know, just a more slicker kind of vehicle than older Hong Kong cinema. And in some ways, you know, Wilson Yip would be a good example, who we've spoken about before. I think he lost a bit of his wackiness and lost a bit of kind of, you know, the, you know, just the kind of the feel of his old stuff, like, you know, Bullets of Summer, Bio Zombie.
Can I just tell you something? I don't really, I'm not blaming you, but I don't really like the notion of wording it like that, and I'm not saying it's your fault. If people are wording like, oh, cinema has lost its soul, I think that's so goddamn cynical.
I agree. I mean, you know,
I believe in positivity. I believe in change. For it could be bad change, but, you know, he's lost his soul. The cinema's lost its soul. I think it's so easy to sound off on the internet like that, which is one of my dislikes when speaking of, like, Hong Kong cinema is not as good as it used to be. But, you know, pardon me, you were talking about By Zombie and Wilson.
It's I mean, it's a double-edged sword, really. Yeah, we have a Wilson Yip. I think, you know, he's lost a bit of, as I'm saying, that kind of feel of his films, that kind of, you know, that Hong Kong flavour, but I think he's making better overall cinematic pieces that can sit alongside anything Hollywood can offer.
What do you think he's lost it? Don't you think this is if talking to him, a direction he wants to go? I mean, it's not like he was forced to do one big commercial film. He whiffed on Ian because obviously there's something there. There's a collaboration there that works. So I don't think maybe he hasn't gotten in him anymore to make Bullets Over Summer, Juliet in Love, which is well over 10 years ago.
It might be age. It might be, you know, him wanting to kind of, you know, make money and have his films more international. It might be, you know, Donnie's influence. Because, I mean, Juliet in Love is kind of a transitional piece, if you agree, Ken, from his older stuff, like Bio Zombie, to his newer stuff, because you kind of get a best of kind of both worlds there.
It's the best of his movie because it's quirky, really complex, and
that's in the scope of his later work.
Yeah,
I feel personally, and I think that's why that works. I mean, he's making overall cinematic kind of. They've got more of a budget to them. They've got that Hong Kong flavour there. A lot of people might think that, you know, it's slightly diluted from the older stuff. I mean, rather than rough and ready, over the top Hong Kong cinema, you know, you're not going to get those type of films anymore. You know, but on the other hand, you're having a more slick and more, you know, well-produced product than the older films. And, I mean, you can argue, you know, all night and all day whether his heart and soul is in these films. I think most of it's Donnie in a collaborative effort with Donnie, because that's really the path he seems to be, you know, wanting to head down and wanting to keep producing more films with Donnie. And maybe it's just, if he wasn't producing films with Donnie, he might be making films like Bio Zombie 2. You know, we don't know. We can't say that. So it's arguable whether it's his own choice, someone else's choice. You know, there's a lot of factors into why you'd make these, but I think in general it's just the business itself that these films, these rough and ready, you know, we can say shoddily made because we love them. You know, we can say that films, they're not going to be made anymore. So I think he really is jumping on what is going to sell and what's going to get international. And if you look at a lot of Hong Kong's, you know, filmmakers now, he is one that has had his films distributed in the UK, US, you know, everywhere, cinematically and DVD. Mm-hmm. So obviously he's doing something right financially.
It's obviously where Hong Kong cinema is kind of at right now, for better or worse, that, it, you know, everybody wants to make a buck, and you go where where the market potential is and all of that, and it is not the same anymore. I mean, it's always been a business, of course, but more than ever, I think it's very evident that it's a business, and it's not a pure bad thing. What people, I hope, are not forgetting when thinking back on the wonderful memories of 80s cinema, of 90s Hong Kong cinema, it wasn't exactly quality across the board.
Yeah.
You know, look at some of the classic Sammo and Jackie movies. We're not talking even movies filled with completely successful elements all throughout, but that's true for so many Hong Kong movies. You know, the memory is strong of the fantastic stuff, which is fine. And remember, all you loved a flawed cinema in actuality. If you want to be critical about it, but I'm not. You know, because I had fun, you had fun. You had fun, Tom, and I'm sure the same can still be achieved in a different way, because things have changed, although it's not as thriving. You know, who can maintain a high for multiple decades? Yeah, so I'm hoping when I don't know what you're picking up on when reading stuff on the internet, if people are looking for the same, or if they're smart and thinking, can't we get a variation of it? Because if they are looking for the same, then my God.
It's not gonna happen.
You know, don't. You know,
I'm
not praying for Johnny Toe to make Eighth Happiness again. You know, I could have been dumb and done that. You know, please make Eighth Happiness again and die and fucking Fun the Luck and Tycoon and you know, fuck the mission. I want the Fun the Luck and the Tycoon. You know, you can't be doing that. But you know, in all honesty, what are you picking up on when reading stuff out there?
I mean, I think a lot of people. It's just mainly, you know, you probably read the same, Ken. Just people kind of wishing for the glory days and the wishing for kind of have this back, and then, you know, it's not going to happen. People are older. Is one of the main factors, and also just the production has just completely, you know, decreased from, you know, post that late 90s period. To now, it's slowly getting back, and there's a lot more films being produced. But if you're talking about back then, when you have so many films produced a year with the same people, Simon Yan, I'm looking at you, you're not going to get
that. He's still in every
single film. he's still there, but in terms of his output, you know, early 90s, kind of mid 90s, it's crazy. It's crazy to think that people would look to Hong Kong cinema now. I think that's it's still the same thing. I mean, there's growth there, there's progression there. There might be not growth and progression that people agree with and generally want to see. They want to see, you know, raw, gritty, kind of, you know, as I said, flawed filmmaking still happening. And that's how Hong Kong cinema has always worked. You know, you rarely have films that are complete successes. It's normally a mishmash of genres and a mishmash of good and bad elements, and that's what we love about it. And you're not going to get that now because it's not going to sell. Because you're pretty much, with the influence of mainland Chinese cinema, which is definitely playing a part, and censorship from that, you know, from that area, which is definitely playing a part. I mean, a lot of co-productions are the norm these days. Choi Hawk's Detective D being a prime example, which I spoke about. And really, we're getting a lot of Chinese-flavored, more slick, you know, dropping the kind of craziness, violence, silly humor, which was a staple of most Hong Kong genre cinema pre-handover, is kind of getting dropped, and we're getting more of a, yeah, more of kind of, you know, we're getting a lot more kind of period pieces because they're selling well to the mainland.
To bring in some current news, I think in regards to that, Painted Skin 2 opened up in the mainland recently. I think a huge business, so it's still, you know, period and fantasy. It's still doing great in the mainland, so no wonder they want to produce a sequel in that case to Painted Skin.
No, it's true. Yeah, it's very true, and that's just
the. Is Donnie in the Painted Skin too, by the way?
I think so.
Regardless, don't look it up now. It's just a. well, keep talking, and I'll look it up.
Why have I got distracted looking at Donnie now?
Hi, Donnie.
Donnie painted skin.
He's actually not in it. Chow Chun is in it again. Whatever. But you know what? Let me focus on me for a while here. You know, it's good that you're a driving force for this kind of discussion, because I do think that no one should turn to me for an answer to the likes of, you know, what do you think of Hong Kong cinema now compared to then? I'd rather turn to the likes of you, because you have a good take on it. Kevin Ma, Paul Fox over at the East Screen, West Screen podcast. They live in Hong Kong. They review the current output. So I get my stuff from...
What do you think? Let's have your opinion. What do you,
know, you,
think?
You know, I have put together what I can. So, you know... because I really, really tried to put together something on it, but it's not cynical at all, and it is something. So I'll give you my take. I barely watch anything new that comes out of Hong Kong cinema. Not out of disgust. No. Not out of disgust or anything. But my broad focus on Taiwan and Hong Kong of a certain era and genre, again, early 70s and 80s and Category 3 movies and IFD and Filmox output, in addition to whatever coverage we do over here at the network, you know, plus whatever else I watch that I don't work on, you know, Italian horror or whatever, it's hard to focus on it all, obviously. And what I did have a focus on more current Hong Kong output once, because I wrote about it. It just felt good switching tack, not because I felt bored, I just wanted to switch tack to the focus I described and to go where the fun and the kicks are. So I've not watched in years, you know, the Johnny To movies, the Herman Yao movies, Derek Kwok, Pang Ho Chung. I will review Dream Home eventually. But it's, you know, these are all awesome directors making how many movies they are making, you know. And if anything, my coverage of those directors, as an example, they will be watch only. But even that I don't have time for, because I have so much other stuff to watch. But Losing Its Soul, again, I really dislike coming at it from that angle. I'm not saying you know, but an air of nostalgia is, you know, fine, but you gotta tune yourself really to adjust to you can't long for something that has been. You can only live in the now, and unfortunately I think some are not tuned in that way, and that's certainly. I understand it, but it is illogical to think that action and action performers will do the same thing, that we will get the exact same thing. But I know also for a fact that these people out there, they are longing for a new generation of action performers, a new bread. And unfortunately, we never got that. It seemed like the last class, kind of, was the Jackie Chan Sammo Hung class. And now action occasionally pops up in Hong Kong cinema, obviously, but you know, it's countries like Thailand that's you know, shining more brightly in terms of that, and it's coming out, new performers are coming out of Thailand and all of that. So my point is, I guess I may not approach much of the post handover stuff, I don't have a hate for it, and I don't have too much of a knowledge of it. But it's a good point that you brought up, though, that this mainland merging is overall a bumpy ride, as you kind of have to compromise to get into the market. I've heard that, you know, to make it China friendly in order to get into the market. But famously, Derek Yee was one of the filmmakers that refused to play to the mainland market with Shinjuku Incident. He made the movie he wanted to make, and they said, no, you can't show it unless you either reshoot this and retool storylines or whatever. And he said, nah, I'm not going to do that. So I'm just going to play my movie in Hong Kong. And that was really brave, because this is a Jackie Chan movie we're talking here. It might not have been the Jackie Chan movie that we know, made out of a template as such, and I like that you that you got integrity in that you got filmmakers with integrity in that regard. And Shinjuku Incident, I mean, it is a good film and all of that. So but I've heard, I don't know how much you know of that bumpy, you know, bumpy trouble relationship with the mainland and compromising your visions, if you've heard it's extensive or through movies realized yourself that I can see where they had to alter this to get into the mainland at all, you know, and therefore reduce the movie quality. Or what have you picked up from viewing movies in that regard? I mean, well, Detective D, you mentioned, is that an example akin to that?
Mostly I feel like, you know, the violence isn't kind of overtly shown, or you know, there's not a kind of lot of blood and gore. It's just the one thing, you know, it's a, yeah, swearing as well, sex. It's pretty much, it's bad to say it feels neutered, but it does. It feels like there's no kind of, it feels very family friendly with most cinema these days with that. And I mean, you could see that creeping in. And obviously, there's always been a kind of influence from the mainland in terms of censorship, dating, as, you know, far back to, you know, the big Mr. Fury all the way down to Infernal Affairs. There's always been kind of a hand in, this needs to be cut, this needs to be changed, but never to the degree of, this needs to be changed for the whole audience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, exactly, because they knew beforehand, I know Infernal Affairs, I would definitely say that they knew beforehand that during production we need to shoot this ending, because otherwise we won't get into it. It was not like they submitted it and said, you go back to set. And you pay Andy Lau more money and Tony Leung more money to shoot another ending. Go!
Yeah.
It dates back to even Naked Killer. I think it was not mainland related, but I think the Malaysian version has alternate footage where Ching Miao's character is an undercover cop in Naked Killer. It's fucking amazing sounding, that the alternate version. But they knew what they had to prep then as well. But as you said, you still got a... The number one vision was still the main one. You know, it was not the one that was sent out to everyone.
No, that's the one that's the one that's going to be seen the most. And, you know, mainland China, they have their cut. And it seems now there's less of a kind of, you do your cut, you can show that in Hong Kong, you show it to an international audience, we'll just have our cut. It's more, you need to cut that to kind of, you know, appease us as well. Mm-hmm. Like, you need to have one cut, for everyone, and we're not going to show you film, as you said, with you know, Derek, he's one of the, fuck that, this is my vision, I need to show it, and if you know, I'm not going to cut it for anyone. And it feels like now that maybe if he'd made that film 10 years before, he could have had his Hong Kong cut, he would have cut it for a Mandarin audience, he would have showed it there as a different cut,
yeah,
and that would have been it. When now it's like, you know, you need to cut it completely. They need to change the core of the film.
Well, you've got mainland money in there. That's a problem as well. You know, you've got co-productions. They have the right to say, the production side from the mainland side, have a say in it. You know, we put money in it, so this is a condition. So take it or leave it. So, and again, I'm not speaking of it in a very educated way. I've heard but not seen many examples of, I can see you here, here's the compromise here, and I don't like it. So I mainly picked up on it, but you know, it's a very real thing. It's not a silly internet forum rumor, these things we're talking about with the mainland or what have you.
No, it's fact that there's a lot of, you know, we can't say whether visions have been compromised. I can't say whether Choi Hawk's vision was compromised when he made Detective D, but I'm guessing that with the mainland money, he obviously spoke, you know, must have spoke to finances or been advised on certain things, because obviously it's Chinese money on it, you know, which he wouldn't have had when he was making films in Hong Kong, but that was a different time, a different decade, there was a different kind of period of films and a different amount of kind of films being made. Mm-hmm. When now it feels like possibly we might have had a different film if we were still living in those times and he was still producing films to those tastes. But I just think, you know, it's how it's going to be. And unless, I mean, I can see Hong Kong cinema picking up on its own and it be, you know, producing more self-financed films. That's not to say that there's no films that are, you know, entirely Hong Kong cinema finance, because there are. It just feels like with a lot of the big filmmakers, you know, Choi Hawk, to name one, mm-hmm. they're going to kind of be in a production which is co-produced, because in terms of people wanted to see that film, and in terms of the money being, you know, the money being spent on the film, he's going to have to. He's kind of, you know, it's kind of, you've put yourself in a corner really there by going along with the trends of what's going on. And the same with, you know, Wilson Yip. I feel like he's probably somehow managed to escape it a bit, because he still brings in the kind of the Hong Kong cinema audience that crave for that kind of 80s action, because obviously with Donnie, and Donnie's kind of bringing that back now, but possibly with films that are kind of trying to break ground, like Detective D, and films like that, they're going to be compromised somewhat in their vision, mm-hmm. is what I feel. And that's, as you said, Ken, I mean, you saying about, you know, the amount you watch and stuff. And I, you know, I'm the same, really. I would never go on records say it's soulless or to go that far, there's no soul to it, because obviously there's a vision there, but it's just how much has been compromised and how much has it been changed to appease a certain audience, which is you know, you can't help but think that when you're watching films like these from Hong Cinema from the past 5 years or so.
Very much true, but I never do like when I pick up on the bus out there that people are angry because someone did something wrong, and they are angry to the point where, you know, I demand a change, and I know exactly what you have to do to change that, and essentially they're saying, reduce 30 years of your life now, and make police do it again. Thank you. No. You know, stuff changes for better or worse in life and in general. And Hong Kong cinema isn't thriving as much, of course, but I think it's a waste of energy to say it's dead and blame it for being dead. And as I said earlier, high can't be maintained, you know. And while I'm sure fans and filmmakers would like to see a big change, you know, to produce a lot this year and have the box office be great for every Andy Lau move, for all the four Andy Lau moves that come out that week, you know, it's not like that. It's still a struggling market looking to make money, and they are making money over there in the mainland. Hopefully it trickles into Hong Kong and all of that, and they are catapulted their trousers down a little bit for the mainland, of course, but overall, I mean, there will never be a shortage of films. There will still be something there, even if it's not 10 great movies that I can watch. Maybe it's 2 or 3, but man, are they great, you know. And Hong Kong cinema always comes back somehow, you know. Remember end of the 90s where it almost went away, you know, due to piracy, and it did bounce back.
Yeah,
from the threat of piracy. So there will always be some joy, and they will rise again. In what way, we don't know. But stop longing for what it was like, and just enjoy the development in the people you did like back then. You know, enjoy the development in Jackie Chan. I think there's good development to be had. Little Big Soldier is a good example.
Yep.
And live in the now, please. And come on, let's make happy and all that. You know.
that's a good way to summarise, Ken. I mean, just to kind of finalise my thoughts on it. I mean, just after Handover, there wasn't a lot of, you know, particularly great movies being made in that late 90s period. As you say, Ken, like, they're affected by piracy.
Yep.
You know, the Handover's coming, and to be brutally honest, there were established filmmakers still churning out pretty good films, but not a lot of new blood. You know,
Wilson Yip came during that period.
That's one example. Wilson Yip and Fruit Chan possibly aside, and a couple of others. But I mean, you know, you look at Sammo's career and what he did best, making crazy action flicks, died just before Handover, and it took a long time for that crown to be picked up again by Donnie. So I think about it really, it's in terms of what audiences want now, and it's what they need, and it's not particularly not catering to people that are still in love with the old stuff. They're catering to the now.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I think only in the last 10 years or so Hong Kong cinema has found its feet again, and I mean, a massive difference for me personally is I'm more likely to sit through a completely random, you know, piece of shit from the early 90s, no matter how bad it is, than a random modern day film, as I know at least with the older production I'm going to get a bit of that flavour that I crave from Hong Kong cinema. And really, that's the only big difference for me from the older stuff and the newer stuff, that it's just possibly sit through things you wouldn't normally sit through in a setting in terms of like a modern day film, because, you know, it's got that mainland flavour to it as opposed to that kind of wacky, crazy Hong Kong cinema that is double-edged sword, and it's now, it's not neutered and soulless, it's a different type of Hong Kong filmmaking. I think everyone should jump on it and support it for what it is. Okay, so the second topic we can kind of get into now is in terms of the formats and what we watch Hong Kong cinema on, DVD, Blu-ray, torrent, just which we think are still relevant and why what they are. I mean, in terms of a lot of stuff being available, I mean, it's all over the formats. I don't think there's been one format that Hong Kong cinema has kind of thrived in. I think it's been, you know, I mean, aside from VCDs, you could argue probably the biggest selling in.
Widest, rather. Maybe not thrived in, but they're more widely available via VCDs and laser discs and tapes. But the VCDs for sure, based on the economics of it all.
Yeah. I think VCDs are great for collectors, but I think they're becoming no use to kind of casual fans, because in terms of the quality's not the best, but in terms of probably better Ripta films being available via torrents and via downloads, and that obviously is still a vital source of fans, and one that will only get bigger and more used, in my opinion, although we're not, you know, not supposed to, but for stuff that's rare and it hasn't got a distributor, I think it's fine too. And I think in terms of, you know, even testing out films and then later on buying the, you know, DVD or the VCD, I think is perfectly fine. I think it's a vital kind of tool for us who like cinema that genuinely, you know, kind of some of it slips off the map sometimes. Nobody's Hero for a you know, a prime example of, you know, trying to source that down and trying to, it's tough at times. I think that's the one that I think in terms of anything Hong Kong cinema kind of relies the most on, and for us in the genre, because a lot of the stuff's only available on, you know, dead formats, and I do the whole finger thing when I say dead formats, because they're not dead to us, but in terms of the mass market, they are dead, but a lot of stuff is available in those dead formats that is just not available now to buy.
Very true, very true. It all comes down to this, though, for we're movie lovers, and we can watch movies on pretty much any format, as long as quality is you know, acceptable. You know, the quality of the movies do shine through, and when I say acceptable, it doesn't take much for me to accept something. I mean, compromised presentations are out there, you know, cropping off subtitled movies where the subtitles are barely on the screen anymore. That you know, obviously you do need widescreen in some cases for Hong Kong cinema, but I still think focusing on DVD is a terrific way to watch movies. Despite the DVD quality coming and going, of course, due to sloppy companies, print sources not being the best and all, but I don't know how you are, but I never sit and long for, you know, full-on sharpness and HD for Nobody's Hero or anything like that, you know, because as fantastic as HD is when done well, it's not mind-blowing and makes you want to take crap on the DVD.
Not that far.
Depending on the DVD, but you know, New Police Story, take this.
Yeah, it's definitely the best format, I think, still for Hong Kong film fans, because a lot of stuff's available in great quality, and I think Blu-ray has not yet. I don't think the format and the distributors have quite found their feet with it. And we're getting a lot of kind of the exact same transfers or mediocre transfers as the DVDs, just upscaled in HD. So yeah, people with HD upscaling on the DVD players have no use for a lot of Hong Kong Blues.
Yeah, I think therein lies the problem, that they want to make money based on a shiny new format, but they don't have the money to back that up, so they do what they do, which I realize, but it's kind of awkward. That you are all getting a bogus product, and it's a kind of desperate call out for, please, we gotta make some money on this. No one cares about DVDs anymore. We'll put it on the shiny new Blu-ray case, and it says full HD, and it's not. So I get it in a way, but it's a shame that it's a desperate tactic too. It's a company tactic, and you know. I'd rather still buy DVDs of Hong Kong movies than Blues most of the time, because I know it will be sufficient even for new movies, and then some, because especially if the movie is awesome, you know, you don't think of, I can't see all the wrinkles on Anthony Wong or Lau Ching Wong's face. You know, it's not that we've not turned into, you know, it's not stupidity akin to that, and therefore DVDs are very relevant. Blu-rays as well, when done right, is very cool, but I'm not converted, and I'm not thinking of ever converting in terms of, like, let's sell all my DVDs to upgrade to Blu-rays, because it's not really possible, and it's not a well thought out prospect.
It's still not there in terms of just DVD distribution, Blu-ray distribution in general for, you know, all films. I think it's still a game where it's hit and miss. Mm-hmm. A lot like when it, you know, DVD first landed on the shores, it's really, like, you know, hit and miss in terms of how well it's going to be, because it takes work to produce a Blu-ray. It's not, you know, you can't just slap it on there. You need to kind of sort it out, and you need to kind of do work to it to make it appealing to the fans. And I think
And companies are not film lovers when it comes down to it. Because the investment into a full HD experience is a pretty great one. I mean, great. It is an investment in terms of striking an HD print. But unfortunately, there is the notion out there of stripping away film-like quality of films. And I'm talking by removing grain, therefore removing sharpness, which is a shame because the experience does feel wrong and awkward when a movie has been filtered, you know what I mean?
The soap opera effect, as it were.
Exactly, and it's that kind of thing where you feel consciously that something is wrong here. It's awkward.
How are you supposed to enjoy a film if you're feeling like that?
Exactly, but then again, if you flip it, when done right, if they just preserve the film-like quality of the print they've struck, if they have been able to do that, I bet your audience will not notice. You know, just like well-done action scenes, you don't say, that was well done, like you do on the flip side for a bad action scene. That was not well done. You know, you just go with it, and you go with the flow. And some movies, of course, can't achieve super sharpness in HD for sure due to age and storage, but, you know, there is a proper way to do it, and it seems like such a hassle to mess with prints, you know, okay, maybe the filtering process is a very simple one. Click, filter. Okay, done. Put it on disk. But then you have stupid companies adding fake grain to cover up their tracks. Crazy. I mean, talk about hassle. They won't notice us.
I don't understand the thought process behind that, really. But I think when it's done right, it can be done right. And it can be, you know, close to mind-blowing because you're seeing these films in a way that you've never seen before. But I'm not going out of my way to see, you know, wrinkles and flaws on people's faces. Because for me, that's silly, and that's people that, you know, they kind of get obsessed with seeing, you know, everything in HD, and it doesn't have to be like that, because you're missing out really on the core of what that's there for and what this film is there for. It's, yeah, you know, look beautiful, but to look unnatural. It's quite silly, and I think it's very hit and miss with Blu-rays now, and that releases are coming out, and you know, 50% possible. I don't know, 50%, 60%. You know, that are kind of the coming out, and they're wrong. They're just wrong. You know, they're not done properly.
Feel it. I actually bought as a totally unrelated example. I bought the Cannibal Holocaust UK Blu-ray. Did not look good. It looked smeary in motion. You know what I mean? But I wanted it mainly for extras, the new extras. There is a better DVD of Cannibal Holocaust out there, even though I'd rather watch my Laserdisc of Cannibal Holocaust, which neatly leads us into why I love to collect on Laserdiscs for certain movies. This is where my nerdy mentality comes in, because Laserdiscs look cool, and they're big, and they have sometimes gatefold editions. I mean, what I would love to own from Hong Kong cinema is the gatefold for Ashes of Time. It looks beautiful, and it's a good one. It's the old edition. It's not the Redux one. Get the fuck out of here. You know, big cover art looks cool. It looks good on the shelf. And for Hong Kong movies, you know, the Laserdisc presentations from cinema prints often look quite good for the format. They're way above VCD. And here's the thing connecting to DVD and Blu-ray. Even if remastered on DVD and Blu-ray, the jump is not very big for 80s and 90s Hong Kong movies. It's not shot on the sharpest of film stock and all of that. So, you know, it's not... DVDs often suffice, even if they reuse the cinema print on Laserdisc, or if they did a universe thing and put optional subtitles on there, it suffices. And remember, listeners, and we connect back to the Tom on Fire discussion number one, just relax and have fun, and don't get hung up on this stuff. I mean, it's not fun to do that. It's not, you know, isn't it fun to enjoy movies? Yeah, shit, yeah. It's great. And on Laserdisc, on VCD, or what have you, And I agree, also file sharing is an advantage, especially for VCD, VHS, and LD only stuff that never reached DVDs, or for out of print DVD stuff. And you have to realize that you find the Holy Grails. Take Nobody's Hero again. The Holy Grail will probably forever be the VHS. You know, that'll be the ultimate edition, and that's fine because the movie still shines through without any problems. And I think it's not necessarily a generational thing, growing up on VHS, that you accept it more. I think if you sit down people just to tell them, come on, just enjoy the movie, okay, I promise, and then they come out of the movie like, not thinking of, well, that was Mary, I look cropped, and the subtitles didn't all weren't all in the frame all the time. You know, I think most of the people, if they see a great movie, regardless of the format, kind of, they will come away enjoying it, because it comes back to that, and you should never either wait around for obscure movies to pop up on shiny 2-disc special editions with tons of extras. No. Get the likes of the 3D Army from the file sharing community, the 3D Hopping Vampire movie from Taiwan. Don't wait around. Get that from VHS, you know. Dubbed in Cantonese from VHS, you know, not even Mandarin. You know, it's all about getting to watch movies, not a way to watch movies, finally getting to watch them. But at the same time, speaking of file sharing, I'm not advocating ripping off
companies.
Exactly, because I believe in testing, but I do believe in supporting as well.
Yes.
But that's a tricky subject, because you know, companies are losing money to an extent still. But in all honesty, for me and file sharing, I most of my downloads are for movies that I've already in rights limbo, totally out of print, or, you know, totally obscure. They're not from the latest Blu-ray release in Hong Kong or anything like that.
From dead companies as well. So
yeah,
definitely. Not, you know, they're not earning anything from it. So, you know.
And it probably was a triad. It probably was a triad run company anyway.
A lot of these places, yeah. I mean, in terms of a lot of the films, you know, you circle around in your torrents and the cinema, it is mostly just kind of dead companies. And I wouldn't download a Blu-ray of something that's just come out from your fucking Warner Brothers or something, because you feel like that's, you know, you're ripping off a company there when you should be giving the money if you love the film. But in terms of testing and you know, stuff like that, I agree with it, and I think it's a vital source for God. But just being a Laserscan, I think the better, for me personally, even though I'm not personally collect, I think it's the best format to collect Laserscans, because in my terms
it's 12 inches of fun, man.
In terms of the aesthetic, it's like bigger, beautiful, and the cover art, it's pretty great quality. And it's the same reason vinyl is the best thing to collect when it comes to music, if you're going to collect down that route, because it feels substantial.
Yes, that's a great word, thank you. I'm gonna steal that one. It feels substantial. I want to watch Ghoul Sex Squad on Laserdisc, because it will feel substantial watching all the fucking.
I mean, it's just, you know, even if you're not like me and not heavily into collecting Laserdisc, you can still, you know, see that it's for movie fans, it's the best, because it just looks beautiful.
Yes.
But yeah, I think, as you said, with the blue and stuff, it's definitely still a game where you need to check reviews before buying, whereas with DVD, it's kind of like, oh, I'll pick that up. You know,
Safer bet than Blu-ray.
It's a safer bet. I mean, if you see DVD for a bit of money, you're going to pick it up, because you kind of know what you're getting. With Blu, it's still a game where you need to really kind of find out what have they done to this film, and how have they changed it, and how is this going to, you know, is this still the same thing I'm picking up here? I'm not talking minute things. I'm just talking, as you said, you know, with the grain being fucked, stuff being taken away, or just, you know, people that are going out of their way to buy things on DVD that exactly the same, you know, HD upscale to it, which is, in my eyes, a bit worthless. So, yeah, people, don't go out and sell, you know, all of your DVD collection because you're going to buy blue, because at the moment, it's not particularly...
You're going to turn blue, actually, because it's not that... It wasn't, in fact, a good upgrade. You know, there seems to be no crackdown by the Hong Kong government as such on trying to, like, you know, take down sites, file sharing sites and stuff like that. I don't get that impression that they are going after sites like other countries are doing, you know, quite extensively, even here. So it seems like they're not treating it as the world's biggest problem, because it's a mighty big one to, you know, it's a mighty big one to solve, and the internet is not easy to solve, because if you shut down one thing, it will pop up somewhere else, and so on and so on. There you go. But it's actually you know, we don't want to hurt the industry, but and it's a delicate subject, this file sharing, but you know, I didn't hurt the industry by downloading the 3D Army, which was a VHS rip, you know.
No, it's true. For films that are just, you know, obscure, I think it's one of the best tools that we've got. And I mean, you know, even if, you know, you don't have a lot of money, or, you know, still just go out and support the company, because they're going to bring you along more stuff in the same vein. And if you love film, you would go out and still support companies and not just spend your time, you know, downloading films or film, you know, films that are just available so readily and so easily. Mm-hmm. But for the obscure stuff, it's vital.
Excellent. All right. Is that us, you think?
I think that's it, mate. Yeah, I think that's pretty done.
Well picked, Tom. I'm looking forward to a new Tom on Fire. Don't feel pressure or anything now. That come up with shit! You know, but you know, it's a good...
Here, bud.
but it's a good little mixture to have on these shows. So good on you, man, and looking forward to more.
Me too.
And that is us. So quick contact information before we sign off. And this has been Podcast on Fire at the Podcast on Fire Network. Website for all the shows, podcastonfire.com. Email for all the shows, of course, and just send in whatever you like, hate or praise. But we do like praise more. podcastonfire@googlemail.com.
Death threats welcome also.
Stu usually is the one receiving them first because it's his email account, so he checks them first. So he hasn't forwarded anything to me, you know. Did you know that after the Ghoul Sex Squad podcast, we got death threats? Ooh, boy, really? But you also have the forum, of course. You can still visit that if you registered before. podcastonfire.com/forum. The extra content in the form of the members-only archive is there. But you also have the bonus episodes on the website that we post occasionally. So check that out. Those are only exclusive to the website. They are not available from iTunes or Stitcher. And we also have our two Facebook pages. facebook.com/POF Network is our main page. And also join the discussion group that you can reach by typing in Podcast on Fire Network in the Facebook search box. And just a request to be added, and you'll probably be added immediately. Because I like you all. I'm a good guy. Believe it or not. Follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/podcastonfire. And my free endeavors, sogoodreviews.com, slicakvideo.com for the video reviews, and follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/sogoodreviews. And iTunes, you can subscribe to us via iTunes and download the podcasts to your device and leave us a rating and comment if you like the show. We would very much appreciate that. And stream us via Stitcher, available from stitcher.com to your computer or from your nearest app store. So check that out. Tom KW has his review archive on VCinema. We'll always link to that. And also check out the 44th episode from the VCinema Show podcast featuring a review of Tony Hawk's Green Snake. Very much highly recommended. VCinemaShow.com. And that is us for 128. So I'll be your host, Tom... Jesus Christ. I've been your host, Kenny B. I'm turning into Tom KW. Ken KW almost. I was Kenny B for this episode anyway, and with me was Tom KW.
Yep, thank you everyone, and just thank you for the feedback and thanks for listening.
Right on. See you later.
See ya.